Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So where were you 50 years ago this weekend,
Mark? I would have been hitchhiking with my friend Will down to Clacton-on-Sea in Essex.
Yeah.
In order to go to the Wheely Pop Festival. Generally considered to be one of the low points in pop festival history. Although, of course, we loved it. We absolutely loved it. We were 17. We thought it was fantastic. You know, The Faces, T-Rex, Edgar Broughton, Colosseum, Juicy Lucy, The Groundhogs.
Have you got the full bill there in front of you?
Because I haven't got it in front of me. No, I could.
It's absolutely astonishing how many acts were at the Wheely Festival.
Shall I see if I can find it?
Because
hang on a second.
This was obviously the same summer as George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh. And I think it'll give you an idea of how what short notice things were arranged at in those days, that people decided that they too would put together some massive rock jamboree in aid of, you know, disaster relief and so forth. And they did it at similarly short notice. And I think this was put together by
The round table. Here, I just found the thing. Here we are. The Faces, T-Rex, King Crimson,
right,
Colosseum.
Go slowly.
T-Rex.
Can you go from the bottom of the bill? Can you do
bottom
that?
Of the bill?
Can you? Yeah. Right. We will.
Tiernanogue. Tudor Lodge. Yeah. Is this ringing any bells?
Yes.
Castle. Don't remember them, actually. Principal Edward's Magic Theatre, who I saw.
Of course.
With their non-hit Kettering. The Natural Acoustic Band.
Oh, yes.
The Groundhogs.
Of course.
Hackensack. Oh, yeah. It's in such small type, I can't quite read it. Crow Fairfield Parlour. No,
Fairfield Parlour.
Fusion Orchestra, yeah. Al Stewart. Arthur Brown's Kingdom Come. Barclay James Harvest and Symphony Orchestra. Oh, Lord. Playing Mockingbird. I can remember that vividly. Head, Hands and Feet. Was that Chaz? Status Quo, Stray. Then, of course, Rory Gallagher, because he was compulsory at every festival. Quintessence, Stone the Crows, Van de Graaff Generator, Colosseum, Curved Air, Edgar Broughton, Grease Band, Mungo Jerry. Mungo Jerry, of course, was the reason I think it all happened, because Mungo Jerry had been booked by the Clacton Round Table for their charity event, hoping to get 5,000 people to raise a bit of money. And then I think what happened was the Isle of Wight Festival planned for 1971 was cancelled.
We're going to have to start this again because you know more. Good. This is good.
All right. Well,
good. I think we should start this again.
Okay.
Because I thought it was done. I was thought it was done in response to.
No, it was because the festival was.
Okay. Alex, we're going to start this.
One second. I've got to get this.
Get the whole list up.
Get the bill a bit bigger. There
no problem, guys. I've made a note. All good.
Let me see if I can find it as well.
I've got the bill. I've got it here. Yeah.
Because I think it's really funny to go through the whole bill because.
Yeah.
The staggering number of people who are on is.
Felix, Mott the Hoople. Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, I've got it here.
I've got it. No, it was because the Isle of Wight was cancelled and all these people were available.
Okay.
That's what happened, I think. Yeah.
I'm going to... okay, we'll go all through right. it. I'm going to read from the bottom of the bill and then... Yeah, I get you. Yeah, I'm looking at a bill here. I don't know if you're looking at the same one as I'm looking at. Can you see that?
Wait a minute.
But look at what I'm looking at first.
That's the one I'm looking at.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So I can do the.
Give me two seconds just to get this.
Yeah.
Back
okay.
Up again. Fine. Wait a second. I've now got to get that where I can see it. No. Fuck. Oh dear. Wait a minute. Really? Oh, sorry, I've got about 8 million things open.
Why do you close some of them?
Because I need them all, actually. There we are. That's, oh, no, no, no. Get back to that. Nearly there. Right. Okay. Let's roll.
Go.
So where were you 50 years ago this week, Mark?
50 years ago this week, I would have been on a lay-by on the way to Clacton-on-Sea in Essex.
Why were you going to Clacton-on-Sea in Essex, Mark?
With my old mate William Thompson, we were going to the Wheelie Festival.
How old were you, Mark?
I was 17.
17.
And,
yeah, was this your first festival?
No. I'd done Reading, of course.
Okay, cool.
No, I think it's my second festival. We really didn't even know who was on. But the point was, you had to, it was a festival. Just going to a festival was the exciting thing.
But you didn't have to know who was on, because the answer was, as we're about to demonstrate, everybody. Everybody was on.
Every single person.
I've got in front of me, as have you.
I have. I've just opened it up.
The bill of fare for the Wheelie Festival.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start reading the names at the bottom in a kind of condensed font. These are the ones at the bottom.
Yeah.
Anne Briggs, Assegai, Being, don't remember them, Bellanark, loads of these misspelt, Comus, Country Jug, Crow, Fairfield Parlour,
Fusion Orchestra.
Jerry Loughran, Gnidra Log, of course, I remember
vividly. Hackensack,
Gringo, Louise, Mike Moran, the Natural Acoustic Band, Paul Brett Sage, Principal Edwards Magic Theatre,
who I distinctly remember,
Ricotti in Albuquerque, Tina Nog, because you had to have Tina Nog.
Tina Lodge.
Steve Tilston. Vecchio. I have no memory of Vecchio.
Nor of Home, nor of Castle.
Oh, yes, Home, I remember.
Home. Oh, you remember Home?
I made two albums on CBS.
Okay.
Castle, Mike Saunders, Saturday's special guest. This is extraordinary. Saturday's special guest, Julie Felix.
That's good. And Saturday's other special guest, Julie Felix was Sunday. Saturday was Mott the Hoople.
There you go, Sunday special guest.
There you go.
So those were the kind of foot soldiers down there. They were the poor bloody infantry of this particular military catastrophe. So
nearing the summit, Al Stewart.
Yeah, we're not, Mark. Let's make this clear. We're nowhere near the summit yet.
We're in the foothills.
We're in the foothills. We might be at base camp here. Here we go. Okay. Yeah. Over to you, Mark. Go on.
Al Stewart. I still remember that, doing Love's Chronicles. Arthur Brown's Kingdom Come, which I can remember. Barclay James Harvest, who came on with a symphony orchestra and played Mockingbird. That actual orchestra. Can you imagine? It was ridiculous. Head, Hands and Feet, who I think was Chaz Hodges' group, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Juicy Lucy, of course. Status Quo, Stray. And then Into the Dizzy Heights.
We're getting near... We're probably getting towards
Wembley.
Who had their own caravan in which to change. You know what I mean?
That's right.
The rest of them just got changed in the toilets, I would imagine. There were so many acts there at Wheelie.
There were.
But when we get to the next acts, Caravan and Lindisfarne probably were in a position to demand their own, dressing room or special.
Van de Graaff generator. They probably got towels, maybe cheese sandwiches and pork pies.
Stone the Crow's got soap. Okay. Quintessence's
got a trouser press. Corby trouser press.
Rory Gallagher was probably allowed to drive his van somewhere near the back of the stage.
And then somebody delivered some buns to his tent, I should imagine.
And then we have Mungo Jerry. Now, you think this whole thing started with Mungo Jerry.
Well, right? I do, because I think what happened was, the story was that the Clacton Round Table, the good burgers of, had a charity event every year and had quite a lot of success the year before. Thought they'd go a bit bigger and get a pop group. So I think they'd hired Mungo Jerry, who were, of course, riding high at the time, weren't they, in the summer?
Yeah, absolutely.
And they had Mungo Jerry. They'd worked out, they got this field and they could accommodate 5,000 people. They thought they'd make a bit of money. And then what happened was that there was going to be another Isle of Wight festival. And various groups were therefore penciled in for that. That was cancelled, I think, quite near the time when it was going to happen. and a huge number of rock and roll bands were released onto the market, mooching about in their comma vans and their old beaten up VWs, thinking, you know, where can we play?
I tell you what, this is really interesting because most of them probably had nowhere to live. You know what I mean? They just needed to play. This is a little bit like, you know, they're terrible. Do you remember the post 9/11 when all the planes had to find somewhere to land? There wasn't enough airfield space for them to land. It was a bit like that with rock and roll bands in 1971, because it worked on the basis that at any point, 30% of them were actually on stage. They had nowhere to live.
No, and we're all basically meeting up again every weekend in a different rainy field somewhere, you know. And that's what happened. And then huge numbers of acts were booked. And they probably got them quite cheaply, I think, because they were just, you know, they were available. And as you say, what was it? You either play this or just go home.
So Mungo Jerry ended up halfway down the bill, really.
Mungo Jerry halfway down. Then it was the Groundhogs.
The Groundhogs, of whom more later?
More later. Grease Band.
The Grease Band, the great Grease Band. You know, they never made it on their own, but boy, they were good.
They were great. I saw them several times. Edgar Broughton, of course.
You were not allowed to have a festival without the presence of Edgar Broughton.
Yeah.
Yeah, the police would turn up if you didn't have Edgar Broughton on the bill. Curved Air with the lovely Sonia Christina.
Was it Stuart Copeland possibly playing drums? No, that'd be before his time.
Yeah, maybe. Possibly before his time. Colosseum.
Mighty Colosseum. Fantastic.
John Heisman's Colosseum. And then the three top acts, King Crimson, The Faces, and of whom more later, T-Rex. Now, first of all, there were so many acts, were there not, that the only way they could accommodate them all was the
non-stop music. Sounds great. When you got there, I said, hey, amazing man, the music's going to start like Friday afternoon. It's not going to end until Monday morning. It's like non-stop. Not fantastic at all. Because it meant that all night, I mean, just it never stopped. And of course, you couldn't escape the music because the whole structure of festivals in those days is you only had one stage. It's not like you wander around and go to different stages. True. There was one stage. So therefore, you had to camp. You had to pitch your little spot, you bag your spot as near to the stage as you could do. Also, there are no screens. So you couldn't see anybody in close up. You couldn't see them in the distance. And if you lost your space, you know, if you went off to the loo or something, or you, I don't know, just went off and put your tent up overnight and came back hoping you'd find the space that you were occupying the day before, you'd be out of luck. So people just tended to stay absolutely rigidly guarding that little plot for the entire 3 days. Oh, God, it seems ridiculous now.
So didn't you tell me that the Groundhogs actually took the stage about 3:30?
3 o'clock in the morning. 3 in the morning. I can remember it really well. Oh, it was unbelievable. And there were so many features of that festival that just summed up just how catastrophically disorganized and kind of underfunded those events were. You know, dare I tell you about the latrines? I mean,
yes,
it's famous.
Yeah,
anybody who went. I remember when I was at Q and Paul Denoyer was there and Andy Gill, and we'd all been to Wheatley. We were all roughly the same age. And it was one of those bonding things you felt like people who must have fought in, you know, military campaigns in the past, you know, survivors of Gallipoli or whatever, you know, that if you'd survived Wheatley and was able to just laugh about it now, that was a wonderful thing. But the latrines were literally a trench dug in the ground, over which a scaffolding pole was dangled, upon which one perched if one wanted to make a deposit. I mean, it's just absolutely shocking when you think about it. Isn't that appalling? There was a farmer, I can remember outside, opportunistic farmer, selling what he called sleeping bags. And the sleeping bags were empty fertilizer sacks, which, of course, were paper sacks, still partly full of fertilizer. Now, what use is a paper bag in the pouring rain in the middle of the field, you know, when you're waiting for the groundhogs to come on? Not much. 10p. I mean, it's astonishing, isn't it?
So the real headliners should have been The Faces, but somebody at the last minute thought, no, T-Rex are kind of, they're hip and happening. They were huge in the middle of 1971. They had loads.
Which I remember being pretty disastrous, actually.
It was a total disaster.
Yeah, because The Faces were fabulously hip and everybody loved them. And they were still a kind of underground concept, you know, Rod booting his footballs into the crowd. And T-Rex, of course, had some hits and beat on...
And that was the worst thing you could possibly do.
The worst thing you could do. So I can remember coming on I think Marbone says, hello, you might recognise us from television or something like that. And I can remember the raucous booing. And I can remember my first sight of plastic bottles, spinning plastic bottles with the tops off, full of warm wee raining down on the stage. And he just thought, this is absolutely terrible. So they went down dreadfully. I know, absolutely appalling. So they
warm
went down.
Wee raining down warm on, wee. The, I know, on the, on the bopping elf.
The bopping elf. And the other thing was that the Hell's Angels were in charge.
Of
so we
course,
got there, we told that, oh, you know, that security was the Hell's Angels. Hell's Angels had taken over this broken down old ruined church in the middle of the field. These grotesque gap-toothed orcs in their finery and looking extremely aggressive. And then there was a big turf war broke out between the people who ran the burger stores. Of course, there was no food. So you couldn't buy any food on site. I can't remember there being food. There might have been one vegetable store. But otherwise, William and I brought two loaves of white sliced bread and about 10 cans of sardines. And that was it to see us through the weekend. And there was a turf war that broke out between the people who owned the vans and the security that had been hired to look after them versus the Hell's Angels. And I can remember Hell's Angels' motorcycles were smashed up with stake hammers. And I think one of them was set on fire. So, you know, that was all pretty exciting. And he thought, my God, is this, you look back at it now, I cannot believe it. You know, anything like that was allowed to happen.
Health
and safety risk, you know.
The irony is, you know, 50 years later, we recorded this on Sunday morning, and waking up to the news of that they had to call off the highly organized Welcome Back New York concert in Central Park, which is put together by Clive Davis and featured Bruce Springsteen and Earth, Wind & Fire and Elvis Costello and Patti Smith and probably about 40 different, you know, musical acts. You know, and this was supposed to be New York post-COVID great celebration. Well, the weather front coming in from the Atlantic was so threatening that they had to call it off halfway through Barry Manilow's act, I think. So it just goes to show, doesn't it? Doing anything outdoors
Is always a liability.
Even 50 years later, with all the organization in the world, you know, that could still happen, you know.
But at least they would have had some provisions. There might have been toilets. There might have been food. Well, I remember going to Glastonbury for the first time in about 1990 and being absolutely astonished. And suddenly there was kind of hospital tents and there was restaurants and there was clubs and there was a cinema, you know. And you just thought, what has happened? This is absolutely incredible. This is just utterly transformative.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
You were talking just then about how you kept a sustained body and soul during the Wheelie Festival. And that made me think of something I was reading in the John Cooper Clarke book. We're talking to John later this week.
Which, let's say, is a masterpiece.
It's fantastic. John's book is called I Want to Be Yours. And I'm going to read a little bit because I want to know. Mark and I have been in touch with each other. We've been reading this. Enjoying it enormously. And he talks about when he was a teenager or whatever. He used to go out and he prepared a halfway snack of my own design.
Oh, God, the hollowed out loaf. Yeah, go on, read it out. It's fantastic.
He called it a pork pie doorstep. Here's the recipe. Okay, visualize this, boys and girls. Take one light white loaf unsliced, hollow it out, place three
pork pies
and 8 pickled onions into the vacant space.
And they're going to squash it, was it?
Well, this is the bit that I'm fascinated by. Then flatten the whole thing out.
Flatten it to a giant sandwich. It's unbelievable.
You take it out for the day and it keeps you going.
Keeps you going. 3 pork pies, 8 pickled onions. Oh, my God, almighty. A decimated stomach.
But
it's fantastic.
It's that brilliant.
Book, you and I have so been exchanging little notes about it all week. And it was just a couple of bits that I thought were just so funny. One was a bit where he says that. He's got that kind of intonation and that kind of lilt and rhythm of a Northern club comedian, which he kind of is, really. You know? Yeah. And he says, I'm always being compared to Bob Dylan. People say to me, compared to Bob Dylan, you're rubbish. just these tiny little lines that are so funny and so throwaway. He just never misses the opportunity for a gag. At one point, he goes into a hat shop in London, and he said, "Who wants to be a milliner?"
Yes.
This guy does. And he said, that's just lovely. It's just the extra mile, isn't it?
The observation of tailoring throughout the book is absolutely astonishing.
Phenomenal.
It's loads of terms I'd never heard before. He clearly has sought out the company of tailors throughout his life, you know, so he knows technically every little bit.
He talks about mod suits. He talks about a 38-gram suit, doesn't it? Isn't it a 38-gram suit?
He talks about things like scooped pockets, which I'd never heard this before. And his description of the Beatles when the Beatles arrive is wonderful. And his description of people going wanting a suit like the Beatles, and about how the key feature of a Beatles suit was that it didn't have loads of the features that most conventional suits had.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? He lists all the things it doesn't have. It doesn't have a collar. It
doesn't have pockets.
It doesn't have pockets, or if it does have pockets, it doesn't have the little flaps over the pockets. I can't remember, there's not that many
But basically...
buttons. And the tailor says, if you want me to make you one of those with all those things, know this, know that. No, he said, with all those extras, it'll be this, doesn't it? Such a brilliant idea. It's so funny when he talks about getting to the punk rock stage and he thinks, well, I was fine for punk rock because I had three things that was in my favour. One, no beard. One, thin lapels, wasn't it? The other was thin trousers. And he says, that's the way he looks at it. He looks at it as a stylistic thing. That's why the punk rockers embraced him. Really interesting.
It's fascinating. It's a wonderful read. So we're looking forward to talking to him this week.
Yeah.
And so it goes without saying, if you want to support these activities and also you want to see and hear this stuff before anybody else sees it and hears it, the thing to do is to become a Patreon supporter, and you could do that by going to patreon.com/wordinyourear. And if you can't do that, the very least you can do is subscribe to this channel if you're watching it on YouTube, or if you're listening to a podcast, just leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or wherever, because these things, they do make a difference. Who else have we talked to in the last week? We talked to Nick Hayward. My God.
Nick Hayward was fantastic, wasn't he?
Talking of well-preserved pop stars of the 80s. We've already encountered a few during the last year. Claire Grogan, of course.
Claire Grogan, Toya.
Toya, Murray Wilson, all sorts of people. But Nick Hayward coming
portrait
in the attic. Absolutely.
We held up a photograph of him on the cover of Smash Hits from 1981. There he is. You know, I can't remember how old he is now, like 61 or something like that.
He looks pretty much
identical. Grandfather three times over. He looked fantastic. But the level of preservation of some of those people is phenomenal. Susanna Hoffs, Belinda Carlisle, Roland out of Tears for Fears. Simon Le Bon, Gary and Martin Kemp, they look great.
There was a picture of Simon Le Bon in the paper the other day, said, or on the internet, say, look at Simon Le Bon after all these years. And they were basically expecting us to say, what a state. He looked fine.
He looks fabulous. He looks great.
John Taylor looks
a bit rattled. He does look a bit rattled. But then you feel sorry. I always feel sorry for those people whose a lot of their whole kind of persona was to do with the fact they were so fantastic looking. David Essex. Francoise Hardy, Debbie Harry, David Sylvian. When they walk into a room, there must be that element where people are thinking, my God, this was the most beautiful man in the world. You know what I mean? That must be a terrible burden to carry around. Although they all look great.
I was reminded of this again reading John Cooper Clarke's book, where he talks about, I think in 1964, the first use of the word mod. He read this, didn't he? It was a feature featuring Queen or wherever, I can't remember. And the first representative of this tribe was Terence Stamp.
Yeah.
Of course, Terence Stamp, I still see regularly in Piccadilly.
So you saw him on the tube not long ago, and he's still got
him on the
liquid
bus.
Eyes.
He
and,
looks
you know,
amazing, amazing. And I'll tell you what, while we're talking about him, I must just tell you one thing about somebody who sadly died a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago, Eunice Stubbs. Yes?
Oh, yeah.
The great Eunice Stubbs. Started off as a kind of teenage dancer and I think went along to dance in The Young Ones, the Cliff Richard film, and was cast as Cliff's girlfriend, I think.
She was.
And then later on, she was... Actually, I think I'm right in saying that... I know I'm right in saying the first pop TV programme I ever saw was not 6-5 special or anything like that. It was a program called Cool for Cats. Cool for Cats, which was presented by Jim Dale. And those were in, that was on that, that era when they wished to represent pop music on the television or on film. It was always accompanied by loads of dancers in kind of leotards and polo necks, doing kind of arty shapes against shadowy backgrounds.
Yes.
So that was the kind of shape of it. Anyway, so the thing, Cool for the Cats, they relied on the dancers, and Eunice Stubbs was one of the dancers. And anyway, she went on, she did all sorts of things till Death Is Due Part. She was in that for years and years. She was, you know, Give Us a Clue, all those things. Wurzel Gummidge, wasn't she?
Anyway, he was.
Here's the point. About a year ago, 2 years ago, I was going to the library in St. James's Square. So I was walking down a little street towards St. James's Square. And I saw this woman coming towards me, this very chic figure, really chic figure. It was winter. She was wearing an almost ankle-length, off-white Macintosh, quite fashionable cut. And she was wearing a beret. And she had very distinctive black-rimmed spectacles. And as she came towards me, I thought, my God, that's Eunice Stubbs. And I just couldn't stop my recognition showing on my face. I just smiled.
She would have been thrilled.
Absolutely. I'm gonna, okay. And she smiled back. And she smiled and she said, good morning.
Oh.
And I said, good morning. And went past. And I thought to myself afterwards, I thought, I made her day every bit as much as she
made
mine.
Completely. Completely, because it wouldn't happen very often. Also, it's lovely when you get a bit older. It's lovely to think you were being recognised.
Absolutely,
you still look like the person you used to look.
You didn't look. Didn't she used to be Eunice Stubbs?
You know what I mean?
She looked like Eunice Stubbs. You know, late '70s, early '80s, or whatever she was.
God, she had a career. When she died, I was just googling to have a look at things that people have written about. And I came across an interview she'd done talking about her first ever job. And her first ever job was when she was 16 in 1953. She danced in a Folies Bergères style musical revue called Pardon My French.
Oh,
you can just imagine it. At the Prince of Wales Theatre, alongside Frankie Howard and pianist Winifred Atwell. I mean, that's brilliant. And in this, there was a thing, I don't know what they called them then. They were kind of nude scenes. You know what I mean? Those kind of...
tableaus.
You kind of froze.
You couldn't move.
And the curtain went down, and the curtain went up again, and there would be... There would be people there kind of with nothing on briefly, but they weren't allowed to move because that was illegal, I think.
Lord Chamberlain would close down the bar.
Yeah. And she said they did that first thing and then the curtain went down again and there was a kerfuffle in the audience and a man was carried out, she said, because he'd had a heart attack. I thought that is just fantastic. That's a great start to your career. That's your first. Well done, dear. How was your first night at work? You know, it's amazing, isn't it? Ah, oh, showbiz.
Anyway, God bless her, Eunice Stubbs.
Yeah, yeah.
She, you know, she was a great entertainer for a long, long period of time.
She was.
I see Tom T. Hall has also shuffled off this mortal coil. This is, you know, I was away on holiday for 1 week, and suddenly we have a load of, you know, a load of people to say farewell to, don't we?
Yeah.
Tom T. Hall, the great country storyteller, you know, the man who wrote the Harper Valley PTA and loads of, He was the master, the absolute master of the story song. You get lots of songs that purport to be stories, but don't really go to the end. And I'm going to go so far, Mark, as to read you my favourite. Can I do that?
Oh, yeah, go on. That's wonderful. Yeah, go, excellent.
This is a Tom T. Hall song called Homecoming, which there is a wonderful CD. Actually, you know, there's loads of CDs that are done in the 90s when kind of hipster acts pay tribute to their favorite squares by doing, you know, some old stages songs. One of the best ones is this. It's called Real. It's called the Tom T. Hall Project, and it's got Joe Henry and
Ron Sexsmith, all sorts of people. Yeah,
yeah, and it's got Joe Henry, the great Joe Henry. Does this song that I'm going to read the lyrics to.
Oh, lovely. Go on.
Called Homecoming. Okay. I guess I should have written, Dad, to let you know that I was coming home. I've been gone so many years, I didn't realize you had a phone. I saw your cattle coming in. Boy, they're looking mighty fat and slick. I saw Fred at the service station. Told me his wife is awful sick. You heard my record on the radio. Oh, well, it's just another song. But I've got a hit recorded. It'll be on the market before too long. I got this ring in Mexico. No, it didn't cost me quite a bunch. When you're in the business that I'm in, the people call it putting up a front. I know I've lost a little weight, and I guess I'm looking kind of pale. If you didn't know me better, Dad, you'd think I'd just gotten out of jail. No, we don't ever call them beer joints. Nightclubs are the places I work. You meet a lot of people there. But no, there's no chance of getting hurt. I'm sorry I couldn't be here with you all when Mama passed away. I was on the road, and when they came and told me, it was just too late. I drove by the grave to see her. Boy, that really is a pretty stone. I'm glad that Fred and Jan are here. It's better than you being here alone. Well, I knew you were going to ask me who the lady is that's sleeping in the car. That's just a girl who works for me. She plays a pretty mean guitar. We worked in San Antonio last night. She didn't even have the time to dress. She drove me down from Nashville. And to tell the truth, I guess she needs the rest. Well, Dad, I got to go. We got a dance to work in Cartersville tonight. Let me take your number down. I'll call you, and I promise you are right. Now you be good, and don't be chasing all those pretty women that you know. And by the way, if you see Barbara Walker, tell her I said hello. The end.
That's just lovely.
It's a movie, isn't it?
That's absolutely lovely. You're trying to guess where he's been. Has he been in jail? Don't know.
It's also the way he introduces dramatic things, kind of halfway through.
Yeah.
You know, the mum has died and he didn't come home.
Didn't go to the funeral.
You know, he didn't know he had a phone. Not in contact at all.
That's beautiful.
He wrote a ton of songs like that.
I was listening to a couple last night, A Week in a Country Jail. That's a lovely song.
Oh, right.
Just talking about when is he going to get out and what has he done, you know. I'm wondering when I'm going to get my release. Later on, we got more hot bologna, eggs and gravy. And there's a lovely song he wrote, which is just perfect. He says the one line, which is ain't but three things in this world that's worth a solitary dance.
Oh.
But old dogs and children and watermelon wine.
That's
fantastic, isn't it?
One of my absolute favourite Tom Tin Hall songs, and Kelly Willis, well, loads of people did versions of it, but I think Kelly Willis's version is best, is called That's How I Got to Memphis. And the opening line is, if you love somebody enough, and it's a great opening line. If you love somebody enough, you'll go where your heart says to go. That's how I got to Memphis. Honestly, if you've never heard the songs of Tom T. Hall, do that today, because the riches there are just absolutely astonishing.
And he's got no angle on it at all, has he? There's no position he's taking. They're just stories.
They're just observations.
And he was a novelist, wasn't he? And a short story writer, I think. So beautiful.
He also, I realised, his wife, who died a few years ago, he was married for a long time to a woman who was known as Miss Dixie, and she was herself a songwriter and kind of bluegrass artist, but also she's born in the West Midlands. From, I don't know, Wolverhampton or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she just ended up in, out in Nashville in her 30s.
Yes.
Ended up marrying Tom T. Hall and became Miss Dixie. Anyway, God bless them both.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Okay, any other business? Here we are with Alex Gold. Alex, I understand you've been to the dry cleaner.
I have. I took my Sergeant Pepper uniform in for a bit of a spruce.
This is prior to you resuming your previous career as a Beatle impersonator on the Ocean Wave. How do they respond in a dry cleaner when you turn up with a... What colour is your Beatle Sergeant Pepper suit?
Yes, which one is it? Is it the lemon?
It's John, so it's the bright green one.
Green yellow, isn't it? Yeah.
And I actually said, prepare yourself before I open the suit.
That's great. Do they assume you're just going to, and rather expensively invested in, fancy dress party? Or you then say, no, this party lasts 3 months. It's my job. I am John Lennon.
I open the thing up and poor Sue behind the counter goes, oh, like that.
Right.
And then I explain, actually, I'm taking it on tour. And it starts to make sense in her brain then. But there is a moment of abject confusion because I don't think anybody even goes to fancy dress dudes in Sergeant Pepper outfits, you know?
There's an old joke they used to tell about a dry cleaner, that a man takes a suit to a dry cleaner in 1940 and is then, before he can pick it up, he gets his call-up papers. He goes through basic training. He fights in North Africa. He invades Sicily, fights his way all the way up through Italy, Monte Cassino, you know, all this. He ends up in Germany, you know, in the final surrender, goes through demob, everything, goes back home, pulls out the dry cleaning ticket, takes to the dry cleaner and said, I know this is strange. I brought this in 1940. Is it ready yet? It's 1944. They go, can you come back on Tuesday?
Oh,
anyway, never mind.
Sorry, guys, it's still early in the morning.
Oh dear.
I did. You might like to know that this week I got a new moustache. Actually, do you want to see it?
I got go a on, new moustache. Oh, good. Go on. He's going to his dressing up box. So, how do you get a new moustache? What happens? You order it. You get it with the back page.
What
of the
was
anime?
Wrong with the old one? They just wore out, or is it shape?
They
or?
Do. So after a little while, of, you know, 2 months of putting spirit gum on the back of it, it just becomes a bit manky and horrible. So you've got to replace them. So you go to beardsandmoustaches.co.uk, which is a beard and moustache specialist, and get one of these Zapata moustaches.
Right.
So it's basically, the one you've got to get is a sort of Mexican-style moustache. Zapata was like a Mexican...
revolutionary, yeah.
And that's the tash that works for Lennon. You've got to get it in a slightly lighter colour than your wig, apparently. So I've got mine in light auburn, and it's there if you're watching this in the visual realm. And that's what I'll be putting on my face with.
See, if the enemy was still around nowadays, some bright spark would take out classified advertising to sell rock and roll mustaches, wouldn't they? You'd be able to buy a Jeff Skunk Baxter mustache or a Ron Mayle,
absolutely. They'd be selling out of those at the moment.
There'd be all kinds of things like. We wish you the best with your new tash.
Yeah, this time of the week you'll be on stage, won't you, in the Mediterranean somewhere?
We're sailing a week today.
We are sailing,
and we are sailing, and we have a week of. There's a test cruise that goes on before, so. There's volunteers that will come on and we'll do, I think, one show that week. And then the first public cruise is the week after.
It's a test cruise.
A test cruise.
Yeah. You get people who test holiday makers, do you? It's like people who pretend to be holiday makers.
So do you actually sail somewhere? I mean, you leave port.
I'm pretty sure we do.
And
I don't
they have
know
a night
exactly
in the cabin making sure everything works.
Yeah, I mean, the volunteers sign up to be pretend passengers, I suppose, just to make sure everything's okay. It doesn't normally happen. It's happening now because of the pandemic. I think that they're doing it more to test the protocols are sound and, you know, everything they've got in place to make sure everybody's safe and can still enjoy themselves is working as it should. But for us, it's great because it means one show a week.
What a dosser's gig, you doss. Absolute doss, isn't it?
And you
Here's a pile of old rope.
But you don't even have to pack up your gear at the end of the show, do you, Alex? Do you have to?
No,
do that?
we shuffle. So they built an actual cavern club for us on the ship on Deck 8. So we just
with a little brick arch. You mean?
Yeah, it's got everything. It's co-branded, so it's all official. It's got all the logos, the back wall, everything like that. But so we just shuffle 300 yards to the venue with our little costumes, put them on, go out. Do the gig, 45 minutes, take costumes off, go back to the cabin, head to the crew bar. Happy days. It's
and the stay there for 3 months. Yeah.
Oh,
my Lord.
Yeah, well, actually, it's this, this 3 months tenure. So apparently this time, as far as we're aware, at the moment, we're not going to be able to get off the ship for 3 months.
Are you kidding? Really?
Yeah. That's your downside.
So
literally cabin fever.
It's not the worst place to be stranded ever. I mean, we've got a balcony each, so that's great.
Is that longer than Columbus's crew would have spent on board the Santa Maria? Ooh, in there?
Don't make me think like that, Dave. That won't leave my head for the whole trip. Once that seed's planted.
Oh, dear. Well, the best of luck with that. Anyway, moving on. I was caused to think by a tweet posted by Ian Leslie on Friday night, where he said, tell me some lesser-known Paul Simon tunes to go on a compilation. And I said, Something So Right. And he said, but that's really well-known. And other people said the same thing, but then other people agree with me. And anyway, he put it on the playlist. But it just made me think, how do you define nowadays really well-known? Because it used to be quite a simple thing.
It's the most streamed, isn't it?
Because, well, it has to be now.
That was the old joke when we were at Word, is that you know, that if somebody died, then the newspapers, the Daily Mail, whatever, would always mention their best known record, wouldn't it? So the Beatles were always known as the Hey Jude Hitmakers. As if, in case you didn't know, the Beatles were, oh, Hey Jude, they're the ones who did Hey Jude, you know. But that doesn't really apply anymore.
But nowadays, they do Grammy Award winning so-and-so.
That's right.
That's the way that they kind
Which
of is completely cover themselves.
That means that's why it's worth reading about them, because they're somehow important.
You know? But it used to be that you defined how well-known people were in terms of the number of hits they had and the amount of times their music was played on the radio. So it was the stuff that they were known by was what they played on the radio. You sort of can't do that anymore, really, you know, in the era of streaming. And it caused me to have a look on Spotify as to what are the most streamed tunes by a number of acts. And some of them
we've talked about the Beatles one before, haven't we? Which is
Here Comes the Sun.
It's amazing, but that's the Spotify playlist.
Alex, the Smiths, what's the most streamed tune by the Smiths? Would you like to go, I guess, Alex?
I would say, How Soon Is Now, All This Charming Man.
It's This Charming Man, that's correct.
That's not surprising. Actually.
That's not surprising.
The big opening card, was it really?
So, Bob Dylan, Mark Allen? What's Bob Dylan's?
Well, I think I know the answer to that. I think it's like a Rolling Stone. There were so many others.
Again,
so
it's not surprising. But Leonard Cohen, Alex, what do you think?
Surely it's Hallelujah.
It is Hallelujah. But the interesting thing about Hallelujah, never a hit, was it?
No, it wasn't a hit, and that's entirely to do with the Shrek soundtrack, John Cale version. Jeff Buckley, all those.
That's a classic.
That's what rebooted that.
That kind of afterlife of a song.
Yeah.
So Michael Jackson, what is it, Alex? Would you like to guess?
It's got to be Beat It or...
It's the other one on the same album.
It's the other one.
It's Billie Jean.
Billie Jean, of course.
Yeah, yeah. But I have to say, I was slightly surprised by the next one, Genesis. What do you think the most streamed Genesis tune is?
Well, it'll be one of the pop hits, won't it? It's not going to be Hogweed or...
It's probably not. It's Invisible Touch.
That makes sense. That's a big kind of video thing, and it's a big...
Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. But what is the Rolling Stones' most streamed record tune on Spotify? And, you know, I don't know if you even play it in your when you appear as one of the Rolling Stones.
It was yesterday afternoon, actually.
You what, sorry?
Lovely little Saturday afternoon gig with the Stones yesterday. Did one yesterday?
Oh, right. Amazing.
Playing to a tent of about 1,000 people, sandwiched between a Bon Jovi tribute and Coldplay.
Coldplay tribute.
You were Keith Richards, weren't you?
I was Keith again.
Did you play the most streamed Stones tune on Spotify, which is Paint It Black?
Oh, really?
That's a real surprise. That must have been in a film soundtrack or something, wasn't it?
I don't know. Randy Newman... God, no. Randy Newman written so many wonderful songs. His top five songs on Spotify are all from Toy Story soundtracks.
Oh, wow. You've got a friend, surely.
Absolutely. Yeah. All those kind of things. But I was... other surprise, one other surprise, just It's a good game. You can play this, you know, on a wet afternoon. Just go on Spotify and look at the most streamed tunes. Grace Jones's. What's Grace Jones's most streamed tune, Alex?
Night clubbing.
No.
I don't know why I said it like that.
No.
Pull up to the bumper.
No, it's not. It's La Vie en Rose.
Oh, okay.
I was kind of surprised at, you know. But anyway, and this sort of ties in a bit with what we were talking to Eamon Ford about the other day, wasn't it? And Eamon's book just been published, Leaving the Building, which is about the kind of, it's about rock and roll estates, musical estates, and the increasingly huge business in continuing to represent the repertoire of artists after their death. And one of the points that Eamon makes is that the internet is constantly reshuffling all this stuff, isn't it? You know what I mean? And bringing different aspects of people to the fore in terms of how they fit the contemporary agenda. You know, so it's not simply, if you had hits in the 60s, they remain your big hits.
Well, that's the thing with Here Comes the Sun, yeah, isn't it? It's that people make holiday playlists to play in the car or whatever, and Here Comes the Sun's always on it. So that's completely outstripped.
You're moving into a landscape now where a lot of music's been consumed by TikTok. So sounds trend, songs trend on TikTok, and clips get a million views or whatever it is. And, you know, TikTok itself is a barometer of success for the new generation coming through. And
so how that's going to fit in. TikTok is now bigger than radio, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
People, you know, 18-year-olds don't listen to the radio.
No, they don't. That would be your primal fear if you worked
that's
on Radio
not what radio,
2 or something.
That's not what Radio 1 say.
No, absolutely.
We see radio. This is historically the huge problem of Radio 1 is that it's hugely important to the BBC in terms of justifying the license fee, because it brings on, it ought to traditionally bring on board the next generation, 13, 14, 15 year olds. It's increasingly not the case.
They've moved on.
It has a very, and so Radio 1 is always charged with getting in the new people. And whenever it comes along with new figures, it always tries to spin them as, look, we got loads of young people, and I'm not so sure that they have, really. But anyway, what else have we got to talk about? Have we got new Patreon supporters, Alex?
Yes, we do. And they are Alex Cameron.
Hello,
Alex Cameron. Welcome aboard.
Splendid. He sounds like a sound chap.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Stand-up guy or girl. Scottish. Yeah.
Yes.
Roy Levy.
Good Roy, man. Hello, Roy.
Very nice to have you, Roy.
Patrick Lovell.
Thank you. Nice to have you here, Patrick.
Mr. Tot Taylor, no less.
Tot Taylor. Yeah, he's been very sweet in his publicity for his Word in Your Attic.
Yes, which we did. That appeared in the last week or so, which is an extraordinary listen, watch. Yes, carry on.
Paul Tucker.
Paul, hello, Paul. Nice to have you aboard.
Thank you, Paul.
John McKay.
John.
Oh, wow. Johnny McKay, probably. Ex-Smash Editor. Could be him.
Oh, it could be.
Is it McKay or McKay?
Wasn't there a John McKay in Susie and the Banshee?
Yeah, I think there might have been.
It's M-A-C-K-A-Y,
that was the one in Susie and the Banshees.
Yeah, it was.
Do you remember when they two... I think I'm right in saying this. I say this a lot in podcasts. I think I'm right in saying. Do you remember when those two left Susie
Two
and
members
the
of the Banshees. What they did, if I remember rightly, was they made their beds to look as though there was a sleeping person in them. Am I right?
Yes.
They put all their clothes in the bed and stuffed themselves full of pillows or whatever.
And disappeared.
And sneaked out through a window and went off.
In the middle of a tour.
I mean, it was in the middle of a tour. I mean, just kind of something out of Tom Brown School Days or just William Book or something. It was incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah. Nobody talks about that anymore.
No, they don't.
No. Well, we have done. Anyway, any more, Alex?
One more, yes. Simon Slightholm.
Very good. Slightholm. Good. Well, nice good to man. Have you
Welcome
all aboard today. If you'd like to join them, as I said, patreon.com/wordinyourear. Don't forget to like this podcast or subscribe to this stream. I've got some I've got some questions from the Massive.
Oh, go on, far away.
Blue Mountain asked the question. I'm just going to issue a personal reply to Blue Mountain here. Yes, it would be impolite. Okay. James Wilkinson.
I want to know.
I'll tell you later.
Yeah.
James Wilkinson says, new way is just new ways to sell old albums. You might be interested in this, Alex. How much would you pay to go into a studio and put your vocals or guitar or drums onto the backing tapes of a classic? He says he'd love to have a go at Elvis Costello's Imperial Bedroom. Can you do that? What a lovely idea.
That's a kind of very exalted kind of karaoke, really, isn't it?
It is a great idea.
Yeah, go on.
I'm sure there's all kinds of rights-based hoops you'd have to jump through with the copyright owners.
No, sure. No, the copyright owner would have to, you know, agree. They'd have to advance it as just another way to use their music. It's a very good idea. It's a good idea, James. We don't know the answer, but it's a good idea. John Dredge says, looking, where did it all go wrong?
Oh, my God. As in the girls' magazine of
It wasn't so much girls, was it? I like to feel that actually, well, all magazines, comics, whatever, they all have their time. But I like to feel that Smash Hits rather ushered looking towards the exit. Because, you know, the emphasis on kids moved from TV programs to pop music at that time. It moved from cartoons to song lyrics and posters.
It was fantastically old-fashioned, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. So Neil Lomax is an interesting question. Cherry Red Records, recent bizarre choices for album box set reissues. Debbie Gibson and Sonia are getting the deluxe expanded treatment. She says, am I being a music snob? Or is there still a big fan base for this? Well, I've got an answer for this, actually, Neil. Shall I go first?
Go on.
The answer might be yes and yes, actually. You might be a bit of a music snob, but so am I. You know, fair enough. And there will be a market. But guess I know a little bit about this reissues market. Because they know really well who buys the stuff that they put out. They don't put out anything on spec. They know where there's a market. Because the interesting thing about the record market generally and the reissues market, because here you're talking about physical product, you know, box sets or, you know, compilation CDs or whatever. How are the overwhelming majority of them sold? Online. They're not in shops, you know. So you've got your customer there. You've got them in the crosshairs. You can see what people bought before. You'll be able to see what they're likely to buy next, you know. So they're not, you know, used to be, there was a huge amount of wastage in the days of standard record shops. And they put out a reissue and there would be no copies in the shop at this end of town and 10 copies in the shop at the other end of town. And so putting the customer together with the product was very hard to do. It's not hard to do anymore at all because it's done online.
So Debbie Gibson deserves an audience, doesn't she?
Well, yeah.
Deserves an audience.
I think he's just saying, are people interested in that level of detail? Well, clearly some people are. Andy Turner says, what's the best opening track on a debut album? After all these years, is it still I Saw Her Standing There? The answer is yes.
I think it is.
Well, that's settled that then.
I don't think that was a long debate.
Moving on. What else have I got? Yes, Poppy's from a Tray says, morbid, I know, but the passing of Don Everly, which was announced overnight, made me think of the coming passing of all 60s legend. Well, we'll come to the back to that in a second, actually, because Phil Turner also says, Don Everly's passing, betting without the Beatles. Everly Brothers, arguably the most influential act of all time. It's an argument.
That's interesting.
It's an argument.
They're harmonies, isn't it?
I always say Buddy Holly, but, you know.
There's an irony that, you know, it was groups like the Beatles that kicked them out of the door, really, and yet borrowed so much in terms of their harmonies and their songwriting, you know.
And also people like Simon and Garfunkel. Utterly obsessed with the Everly Brothers.
Yeah.
I tell you what's another interesting thing. We sent you off with the tip to listen to Tom T. Hall if you've never done it. The other thing I'd like to add is that Pete Townsend used to be a big fan of the albums that the Everly Brothers made for Warner Brothers in the mid-60s. Is one called? I can't remember what they're called. They're on Warner Brothers, and they made them in Hollywood. And the Who used to do some Everly Brothers songs. Did the Who do Ferris Wheel or things like that? I can't remember. Lovely Strange.
They did do some.
And those records, which were never big hits, they're fantastic records. Really good. So yes, hugely influential. Phil, certainly. You can have an argument about the most influential act of all time, but I think that's a valid candidate. And going back to Poppy's drummer, Trey, says, what's the music world going to look like when its surviving wise old heads aren't Macca, Joni and Dylan, but Captain Sensible and Simon Le Bon? Okay, well, there's no answer to that, really. Alan was asking about how come it took Genesis so long to get round to the idea of Phil Collins replacing Peter Gabriel when Peter Gabriel left the band.
Did he ever advertise the fact that he wanted to be the singer? I don't know. Yeah, he sang beautifully. He sang backing vocals and all that. But, I mean, I don't think he ever said, you know, showed any desperate urge to get out from behind the traps, did he? I don't know.
Possibly.
Or was he just too shy to put his bat in the ring?
Well, I think also it's probably one of those things that, you know, Gabriel leaves, and Gabriel was the star by distance, wasn't he? And so you go out looking for a potential. I mean, you can't replace a lead singer like that, can you? You know, they're bound to be a disappointment.
They must. That's true. They must have been looking for a kind of Gabriel sound or lookalike.
And then you realize you can't.
There's just no point in getting somebody's third best. Why don't we just get someone completely different?
Well, they probably thought, we don't have to get anybody at all. We just keep going. And, you know, if it works, it works.
Yeah.
And it did. And if it doesn't work, well, okay, we revisit it in 6 months' time and we get a singer or something. You know?
Well, I suppose, you know, when you've got someone as, you know, with as big an impact as Peter Gabriel leaving, it's not, the replacement is not an obvious choice, whichever way you go, is it? You know, it's not something you just snap in to go, all right, boys, I've got it. This is who we're going to go with.
No.
Well, I don't remember ever thinking they'd survive, actually. I can remember. Did you think that they might get over that hurdle? I never did.
No, but I mean, they had, and they still have, because don't forget, they're probably still supposed to be touring when this bloody war is over. They have unbelievable staying power, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
And I don't think anybody predicted
that. And an unbelievable catalogue of hits as well.
Well, they have now.
Yeah.
Absolutely extraordinary. Incredible. Paul Murray says, if we accept the proposition that 1971 was the Annus Mirabilis, I didn't say for music, Paul, I said for the wrong...
For the long playing record.
What year can we ascribe the term Annus Horribilis to? I'll happily volunteer in a year between 1980 and 1983. Oh, I think you've
got a lot of it. Oh, not at all.
No. I think you like that a lot.
And Dexys?
Yeah.
Well, Jam.
1982, a lot of people would say, were they?
They're fantastic. Eurythmics. There was a lot of really good records. Human League, incredible stuff.
So, I don't know. Well,
surely wrong.
Well, can I suggest 1997, which was when Britpop went wrong? Surely that's got to be a contender.
Okay.
How did it go wrong? Remind me.
Well, Oasis released Be Here Now, which is an album that lasted for about 2 weeks. It was not good, and it basically spoilt the whole of music. Really, that was the point at which music became sullied and ruined. And I would suggest 1997 was
spoiled music. The year that wrecked rock.
Interesting point, actually, because you know if you look at the high point of the music business in terms of profit, that was the early 90s.
Yeah,
because CDs were coming out in huge quantities, selling in immense numbers at really high prices. And then they just kind of overdid it. Everybody overdid it. And Be Here Now is the classic example of overdoing it, isn't it? You know what I mean? Yeah.
But didn't that coincide in 1997 with the arrival of illegal file sharing? Because that's when it all started. LimeWire stuff started then, didn't it?
Started.
Suddenly there was not only records that people didn't want overpriced, but a massive opportunity to go and get them for nothing.
Yeah.
So you're right. That was the beginning of the end.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.